Hello, everybody. Thank you for tuning in to another interview for Technology Uncorked. My name is Jeff Quattromani, and this show is brought to you by Boost Mobile. Now, it's been an interesting couple of weeks of people talking about latest smartphones, whether it's from Google, whether it's from Apple, Samsung. So many brands have got new phones out this year, but they're not necessarily cheap. Now, one thing that Boost does have is a refurb shop. And this is interesting. It's worth checking out. You can look at premium refurbished phones where you can save a pretty penny. So a quick example, the Galaxy S10, a really good phone, only a couple of years old, is available here for $659 with a 12-month warranty, including that 30-day guarantee. So if the day you arrive it, too many scratches, too many issues with it, whatever the case may be, you send it back for a full refund. They also give you a free $30 Boost SIM card with every single phone and obviously free shipping anywhere in Australia as well. So if you are looking to save a few bucks, but you still want to have an iPhone, or you still want to have an iPhone 10, iPhone 7, iPhone 8, they've got them all. You can save a huge amount of money just by going refurbished. And obviously, they have this very high quality standard to make sure you're not going to get something with cracked screens and things like that, but it just has been carefully used beforehand. So do check it out. Head to boost.com.au for their refurbished phone range if you want to save a few bucks, but still have that premium smartphone experience. Now, today, we have a really special interview. I'm terribly excited by this. And the main reason being is that this interview is not in any way a marketing type spiel. We have a lot of companies on the show. Sometimes you do have those who are more skewed towards trying to sell product or talk about their brand and drive more sales. Whereas in this case, we talk to James Shale. He is the country quality lead from Tokyo for Dyson. Now, James is actually from the UK originally. He's traveled all around the world with Dyson. And he's worked on a number of their different products in the range. And he can actually give us some really good insight as to where the ideas came from, different innovations along the way. And it's crazy. I mean, just one quick example here without spoiling the whole interview. There were 5,127 prototypes of the vacuum before they got it right. 5,127 prototypes. That is absolutely insane, and it's something that we do talk to James about. Obviously, the vacuums, the fans, they have a lamp. If you've never heard about their lamp, they have one of those as well. And being an engineer, I had to talk to him about, you know, that balance between, you know, engineering and quality versus cost. And absolutely, that's a huge factor when you're making any type of product, but particularly when your brand is Dyson, how does that all fit into things? So tune in. James Shale, the country quality lead based in Tokyo, working for Dyson. Let's go on with the show. Now, James, is working at Dyson the appliance equivalent of working at Apple? I mean, what is the culture like at Dyson?
It's unique is the first word that I'd say. So it's unique, and I think it comes from the structure of the company. You've got a owner and founder that's obsessed with engineering and technology, and isn't afraid to take risks. So nothing is untouchable. There's no mountain that's too big. You know, there's certainly the element of allowing to like explore and play. I studied design engineering. A lot of people study mechanical engineering. It's certainly the most aspirational place for young people to work. It's just totally unique compared to other companies because of the way that it's structured. You don't have shareholders to answer to, and so the way the company behaves is just completely different to how I would imagine any other major engineering company behaves. It's weirdly wonderful.
And look, and from the outside, it certainly looks that way. I mean, whenever we hear about a new Dyson product coming, I don't think there's anywhere near as much buzz around a hairdryer, for example, except when Dyson releases one. It's fascinating what kind of buzz that company can create. And James, it wouldn't be 2020, or especially an interview in 2020, if I didn't ask you some type of COVID-19 question. And I think the biggest one I have to know from a Dyson point of view is, how has Dyson been impacted? I mean, I'm thinking about manufacturing, distribution and things like that. And I guess also, where has Dyson also been able to play a role in getting us through this pandemic?
question. So yeah, definitely you never have a conversation this year without talking about COVID. It's been really interesting. I mean, obviously every company's felt the impacts on its supply chain. But, you know, we've worked very hard to make that a non-issue. And I think in a way it's been really useful for us. So people are really starting to understand the indoor air problem. So, you know, people are a lot more conscious about things that they weren't conscious about before, just how important it is to have a clean and healthy environment. So that's been really interesting. And then I think that the ethos of Dyson at the moment is to make products that really make a healthy home. So you've got vacuum cleaners that are so efficient, they purify your air. You know, when people are at home, they're gonna want to clean a house. So we suspect that the usage profile of our machines has just, you know, increased phenomenally. And then the other thing that's been really interesting is to see the way that consumers' behaviors changed. So the number of interactions we've had on our Australian direct website has been up 49%. Wow. So that's been really interesting for us, where we've had to kind of pivot the business model to move away from this classic kind of conventional model, and people have seemed to have gone much more digital.
And thinking about things from a, I guess, the way that Dyson has been involved in this pandemic, has there been any innovations or products where Dyson has had to change gears or shift their thinking around the pandemic as well?
Certainly, but highly confidential, not one I can share on a podcast.
That's but, okay. You know,
the company always has its finger on the button in terms of looking for innovation. You know, one of the messages that gets put on the wall, and it's not just a kind of PR message, it's solve the problems that others ignore. So it's really looking for a societal problem that you can solve via technology. And, you know, I think one thing that's very, very interesting about Dyson is that because of the way the company's structured, there is this like facilitation of just playing with technology. So a really nice example, a friend of mine was just working on a research project for 2 years, just trying to work out how to break down formaldehyde. So it wasn't associated to some commercial project or any pressures, but essentially he managed to make a filtration device that could break down formaldehyde into just base particles of like water vapor. And that was just him playing with like science and technology. And it ended up on this product called the Dyson Cryomatic. That was hugely successful in China because it is a real world problem. But that's kind of how the company works. We're constantly looking at stuff and playing with it, and stuff seems to flow through the engineering department and come up to the top, and then, you know, sometimes not quite right or needs refinement and kind of flows back round. It's very much a kind of a playground of innovation. It's certainly in the what we call the MPI phase, which is our earliest phase of development.
That story in itself is fascinating, and it sort of helps me understand really my next question in some ways, is that, you know, Dyson is really a company that started off making vacuum cleaners, yet it somehow stemmed into hand drying, lighting, hair care products. How exactly does a new product get introduced at Dyson? Is it just seeing something in the world and wondering how you can make it better?
Yeah, so I think the Airblade, I can start with a really nice story for you. I mean, someone was just messing around with one of our motors, our Dyson digital motors, and for some reason was putting it through a really thin aperture to just see what happened in reverse. And right. Was like, I think I have an idea. You know, they basically created a really thin blade of powerful air. And that was the birth of the hand dryer division. You know, same with the hair dryer. You've got a Dyson digital motor that's been designed, you know, you've got incredible design that goes into it. You've got a ceramic shaft that makes it capable of spinning 110,000 rotations per minute. You've got this device, and all of a sudden you start to think, well, what applications can we use with this innovation? you know, with a hairdryer as well, you've created the fans where you've created this air multiplier technology. So essentially, you spin an impeller to bring air in, and you're firing over something like a hydrofoil to, you know, create incredibly fast-paced air. And the hole in the middle creates this entrainment effect where you get negative pressure. So more air flows into that space. You get an even larger increased airflow. And, you know, you kind of put those things together, and it comes this case of, why would we not make a hairdryer? And that's the kind of way that the company works. We innovate and break barriers with our technology and our scientific discovery, and then we apply it into a project, rather than kind of thinking, oh, we really need to make X project. Let's go off and do that. It's a very unique way of working. And I think it's interesting that failure's okay. So yeah. You try things, and sometimes they don't quite work. And I'll give you a really good example. We made the Dyson Air app, and I think it's been a really phenomenal, unique approach to styling hair without using extreme heat. Mm. But we made that product, and we actually got all the point to having, you know, the product designed, and we put it out for user trials, and it just wasn't quite on point. You know, scientifically and from a principal point of view, the product worked really, really well. But it just wasn't giving the finished effect that we wanted when we put it all around the world in our offices and trialed it. So we just went back and we spent 18 months looking at the most minute details of how we could fix it. And the main body was actually really good and working really phenomenally. But it was just tweaking the attachments. You needed a much finer tolerance on the, you know, apertures that put the air out. And so we just went back and did it again. You know, we weren't concerned about not launching the product and the impacts of that. We wanted something that fundamentally worked really well. And I think we have this philosophy, which is form over function. So you want something to work really, really well. That's the core of a Dyson product. You want something that fundamentally just works for the user.
It's incredible. Even just talking then about the fact that you spent an extra 18 months to refine the product, most people from the outside would have thought that working 18 months on a product could seem like it's too long and that it would be put on the scrap heap because there's just too much work required. Yet here you are saying that just on this one product, there was so much focus on R&D. And, you know, it brings me to that quote that I've seen James Dyson say once before, which was that he made 5,127 prototypes of the vacuum before he was, you know, essentially satisfied. And he was saying that, well, essentially here we're talking about 5,126 failures. And firstly, it's an insane amount of prototypes to think about when it comes to just the vacuum that we're talking about here. But it speaks to the quality of the products that Dyson makes. And is this something that you've seen in your time there, whether it's in the vacuum space or others?
Absolutely. So, I mean, the 5,126 failures is just the start. I mean, you make a product that is revolutionary. I mean, it's the foundation of Dyson and the company that we know today. You make a cyclonic vacuum cleaner, an upright. And then, you know, in James's terms, you would describe that product as a failure, because you've now moved beyond that. You know, you've kind of gone to, from that concept to a product that now doesn't need a cord, you know, has incredibly increased suction power from our motor development. You now have vacuum cleaners that can remove 99.9% of particles down to 0.3 microns. You know, that's the journey. So even when you look at DCO1 compared to, you know, something like the V11 outsize that we have now, the evolution that's taken place in between those two products is absolutely massive. So it's just a question of thinking how you can do something better. You know, like, how do you remove finer particles from the air? How do you get something that is more powerful in terms of suction? How do you reduce the weight? How do you increase the runtime? All of these things are, you know, small problems that you just relentlessly innovate at. And I think one example that really typifies this for me is, we came up with an innovation in the brush bar So our brush bars have two types of fibers. So you've got like a really thick nylon. And the point of that is to just kind of beat the rug or the carpet to get the dirt out to then be vacuumed up.
Yeah.
And you have a carbon fiber weave in the brush bar that uses electrostatic principles to pick up the kind of smallest particles. And you know, when you're talking about innovation, on our latest products, we've just changed the angle of the stitching to make that pickup even better. And that's the level of minute detail that goes into creating a vacuum cleaner at Dyson. I just think it's bonkers, you know, that someone is actually looking at the angle at which you stitch your carbon fiber material. That's just the extent of the engineering typified in something so minute. That for me is the philosophy, and it doesn't stop. We're constantly trying to do things better.
It is crazy, and it makes me laugh, because even just reflecting on the first vacuum from Dyson and thinking about where we are today when it comes to vacuums, since when did people in the world even have conversations about vacuums? I mean, when I was younger, it was a very strange thing that suddenly it was cool to make sure you had a Dyson. Whereas in the past, it was like, well, you just went down to Godfrey's or whatever the vacuum store was, and you just picked up whatever dustbuster you could find. I mean, it changed the game completely when it comes to vacuums, and obviously a whole bunch of other products since then. And, you know, Dyson is a company that's founded by an engineer rather than by a marketer, you know, and that obviously changes the way the company thinks and the way the company acts. But I have to ask, what is the balance in managing the product being ready to sell and wanting to hold it back for further improvements? Because to your point, you can continue to evolve the product and change it, but at some point you must say, okay, we have to stop here and maybe put it on sale, because while there's other things we could potentially do to it, it's actually pretty good to go right now.
Yeah, totally. I mean, I think the fundamental ethos is that you want, like I said, we're constantly innovating. We've tried many, many things. I think that for us, the mark of when we go with a product is we want it to, and I'm going to say this diplomatically, arguably be the best product on the market. So it's got to bring innovation, and it's got to perform in a way that others don't. You know, we're not interested in producing a product that is, yeah, okay, and would have some commercial success and can ride on the name of the brand that we've built, you know, based on the principles. You certainly could do that. I think that, you know, having James as the leader just instills this fact that you're not going to behave like that. You want something that is truly innovative and truly works better, arguably, than anything else on the market. And if that's not the case, you're not going to launch that product. So we gave the example of the Air App earlier. I think that was a really nice example. Yeah. So, you know, you look at the V11 Outsize that we've just launched in Australia.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it is the most powerful cordless vacuum on the market in Australia. It has incredible filtration. So like we're talking about being able to filter, you know, particles as small as 0.3 microns, you know, a really large bin. So it really is fulfilling that need of replacing the conventional corded vacuum. I mean, they're the kind of, that's the kind of stance that we want before we launch a product. We're just so confident that it just works and will delight our users. You know, I think in today's day and age, There's so much global competition, you know, and I think we are very challenged that we are an innovator that people have a tendency to copy, and so to continue the Dyson brand and that piece that you were talking about people being proud about owning a Dyson, we have a responsibility to make sure that our products are consistently at that level of innovation and cause that sense of delight. And I think that comes from having something that functionally works so well. You take it back to the early days, it was having that clear bin so people can just see how effective the vacuum is. Or a more recent example would be our purifiers. You know, people being able to see on the graph, on the screen, or on the app that it is cleaning your house. And if you cook, or if you drive your car into your house, seeing that spike in the pollutant levels, whatever it may be, you know, NO2 gases, PM2.5 particles, seeing that go up and come down, I think it's about really demonstrating why what you have in a Dyson product is superior.
It's really interesting. And I mean, I have the V11 outsize at my place. It's something that we use on a daily basis almost. And it's crazy. That new bin is huge. I could probably fit my head inside that bin. It is absolutely massive, and something that we actually love a lot more now, because we used to actually fill the other one up when we try and vacuum the entire house. So it's incredible. And James, for someone who in your role is responsible for the quality of the products, I have to ask, what is the balance between aesthetics, cost, and then hardware? Because, you know, somewhere there needs to be a conversation about components that, you know, can't be a certain way because of the impact it might have on say the overall bill of materials. Something might be plastic today, but yeah, sure, you can make it stronger, but it's going to blow the cost out of the product. How does Dyson try and balance those kind of conversations?
It's an interesting one, because as you say, there's always going to be a line somewhere. You know, we're not making a shuttle that goes to the moon where expense is out of the question. So there always will be a limit. At Dyson, I think that the limit is very, very high. I mean, I can give some examples. You know, we have neodymium magnets in our motors, which are, you know, really the top end of design. You know, we make the bins out of polycarbonate, which is the same kind of material as riot shields used by police officers in riot situations. So wow. So we do go for the very upper end of spec on materials. But yeah, I mean, obviously there is a limit. You know, you need to keep the bill of materials in line, but it's not something really pondered over. I mean, we're really focused on best performance, and so, you know, it really does come down to, like I said, we've got a motor that spins so fast that you can't use a metal component for the shaft. It has to be ceramic, you know, because that offers, it's half the weight for double the strength. So right. You know, we do use the upper end of materials, but obviously, as you say, there is a limit in there somewhere, whereby, you know, you do need to make something that is within a certain budget, but it's definitely not something that is at the forefront of thinking. You know, it's more about how to engineer the best performance, and then
Just even repeating, hearing you say around the fact that the plastic is what they use for riot shields, and that's just the plastic of the bin that we have on the vacuums. That's madness. That's completely crazy. That should be on the brochure. I think that would have sold it to me much sooner. But I love that. Now, the one product that I have, I remember actually coming to the launch of this product. It was the lamp, but I probably should call it officially the Dyson Light Cycle. To me, is an example of just engineering gone wild. I had never thought that a lamp could be so advanced, and here we are talking about a product that's, you know, it costs $800, but you know, when you start to understand the engineering behind it and things like that, you start to almost in some ways understand that. How has that product gone, and is it something where engineering was really allowed to just do whatever they needed to produce the best desk lamp possible?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think it's totally bonkers when you listen to, you know, what it does. So you have a copper tube that, you know, the problem with LEDs is essentially that they destroy themselves through heat. So you've got a copper tube that draws the heat away from the LEDs. And that enables them to last, you know, for 60 years, which is just bonkers. And you know, we start to get into light and really just try and innovate in that area. The color and the temperature are so critical. So your body is just so attuned to light. You know, the chemicals released in the morning, you know, when you see blue light, you release melatonin, which wakes you up. And then, you know, in the evening, we're designed to be tired. And actually, humans are actually awake more of the day than any other kind of species. And it stems from our invention of fire. It enabled us to be able to see in the dark for longer. So now our body is attuned to seeing these kind of orange tones of light that represent fire in the evening. So you've got a product that has, you know, such high quality LED spec that is going to be preserved over the lifetime of the product, with the ability for the lighting to track the circadian rhythm of your body through the day. You know, the level of engineering that has gone into that product is crazy. You know, the attention to detail that we have. So yeah, it's a very interesting product, and I think we're really committed to the lighting and learning that area and really innovating in it.
It is fascinating, and anyone who hasn't seen this product that we're talking about, you just need to go to the Dyson website now and have a look at it, because it actually looks amazing as well, and would certainly lift up anyone's working from home environment at the moment for sure. And James, when you think about Dyson, or especially when people think about Dyson, the first product that usually comes to mind is the vacuum. And I think that's why I wanted to just come back to that one very quickly. Around, there's been major changes with that vacuum since it's come on board. And especially if you think of the stick vacuum as well, it's changed dramatically. The first edition looks nothing like the current one. And I have to ask, you mentioned a lot around how much continuous improvement there is internally. How much of it is influenced by what you hear from consumers? Because, you know, of all the people who are testing the products, I guess the consumers are the largest group. How do you guys manage all of that?
Well, it's directly my job. So I hope I can give you a good answer. you know, we're not a company that just listens to the consumer and makes what we need. So I think there's a really nice Henry Ford quote, which is, if I asked the customer what they wanted, they would have said a faster horse. So we're innovating, and actually sometimes we innovate in areas and actually have to communicate to the customer why it's so important. So I think a good example of that would be, you know, indoor air quality, really explaining to people actually how bad the situation is, and why you need the Dyson solution. Equally, I think I'm sure, I can answer this personally. I had no idea about the level of particulates and matter and creatures that you can have in your mattress. And that's why being able to pick up particles that are 0.3 microns small is critical. But at the same time, you know, we're really listening to our consumers. So we're always looking at the reviews and doing a kind of quantified breakdown of what people think about our products. Every product that we launch is trialed in all of our major countries. So I gave the Airwrap example before, but we're really trying to understand, rather than what the consumers want, the problems that the consumers have. So if you look in Australia, I believe that the biggest houses on average are found in the US, and then second and third are Australia and New Zealand respectively. Right. So by having that house size, you have a different problem to someone that lives in a Tokyo apartment like I do. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we talked about the bin, and, you know, that users have different needs. So in Australia, with the house sizes that some people have, you need something with a really significant runtime, a really large bin. And actually, by having a cleaner head that's 25% bigger, you're going to save yourself some significant time by having that 25% extra width on the cleaner head is going to save you some real time. You flip it over and you kind of move to Tokyo, which would be the opposite end of the scale. You have users that have an apartment that may be the size of one room of an Australian's house in the center of Tokyo. Yeah. So, you know, subsequently, having a vacuum cleaner that's half the size is really significant in terms of space saving. And true. You know, the floor size might be 1/10 of the size. So actually, you might want something completely different in terms of specification. So we listen to the consumers to understand the problem that we're trying to solve, and then accordingly we can adjust the spec.
Just on that too, because I think as we've been talking, I've been just thinking about the Dyson products that we have, and obviously I've mentioned we have the outsize, and prior to that we had, I think it was the V6 Animal, I think that was the one we had, and the bin has obviously changed quite a bit, but one of the biggest changes with the bin is how you now empty it. And I'm going a little bit off the original questions here, but I wanted to ask, the way that we empty the new V11 requires us to take the wand off the vacuum, and then we can actually open up the base to empty out the goods, whereas in the past, because it used to open, I guess, from the backside, it was actually easier to empty because you could actually leave the wand attached and even the vacuum head attached and just open it over the bin. Is that something that does get considered as well? Or was there obviously a factor that if you're going to have such a large bin, you couldn't put it where it originally sat, it had to be relocated. And I guess that's, if anything, a minor inconvenience when you empty it, even though you're emptying it far less now.
Great question. Well, the answer is we flipped the orientation of the bin. So previously we had it vertical. Mm. And what you needed then was a pre-filter to filter the airflow going into the motor and a post-filter. And actually by flipping the bin, we can make it larger, but you can also make the filtration through the cyclone so good that you only need a post-filter. And that ends up reducing significant weight. And you're also able to get significantly more power out of that orientation. So it's a balance, and I agree with you that it's different that you have to take the wand off. Another advantage is by using that orientation, you have you can scrape down the shroud of the bin. So the primary filtration system on a Dyson is the main cyclone within the bin. Yeah. The secondary one, you'll find a metal mesh that has like over 33,000 holes that have been chemically etched. And so a lot of material is going to get caught on that secondary filtration system. So we have a shroud wipe. So as you eject that bin, you have a kind of seal that goes over the filter and scrapes out all of the dirt and dust and just shoots it straight into the bin. So you don't have to get your fingers in there. So it's a really nice example that you've brought up about, you know, the kind of trade-off that you're looking at. You've got so many variables that you're trying to incorporate into a design. And I think that the decision to do that brings a lot of positives, but then you do have to take the wand off to eject the bin, which you've noticed. But hopefully now I've explained it, you can understand the rationale for why we've moved to that design.
No, absolutely. And I think my original way of just dealing with it was the fact that it was such a big bin that if you had it, you know, vertical still, it'd be look silly carrying it for starters, but it actually makes sense that it's in line now. So I had to ask that question. I promised to not to get too much off script anymore. Now,
no worries.
Now, James,
I'm
sorry,
happy
go ahead.
To answer anything you like. I it's nice to have some media who's actually genuinely interested in you know, our technological development. So it's a pleasure.
Thank you, man. It's not often you get to chat to someone from Dyson. It's amazing. The James Dyson Award, it's one of the competitions that I love paying attention to because you find some amazing innovations that do come out of this and some crazy ideas that you just think, oh, yeah, why didn't that already exist? And that's usually when you've found something so innovative that just makes sense. What are some of the things that you've seen? Because I believe you've judged this award before. What are some of the things that you've seen and been impressed by?
I've got a brilliant story on this one. I've seen two entrances. So I've seen one which I will not say the country or where it came from, but it was bang on something that we have in our MPI development that we are really, really backing to the hilt. And the young engineer that came up with it was just spot on. So that was just phenomenal. So for me, that's the standout that I've ever seen. I'm actually a really big fan of the runner-up in Australia this year. So the mosquito problem, I guess in line with our philosophy, is about solving problems really well. And I hate mosquitoes. So I know Tom's the same as me. We've got this delicious British blood and it drives me insane. But we're fortunate to live in countries where the mosquitoes do not carry horrific diseases. But I think in that innovation, you've got something that's practical, affordable, does the job, and solves a real serious problem. So in some of these countries where you've got mosquitoes, malaria, I mean, it's just such a phenomenal problem that is being solved. So obviously we can talk about some of the winners. There was the team that won a few years back ago that basically made a rapid PCB development prototype. And I mean, it's just phenomenal, because when you look at the design process, you need a PCB and you send it off to a specialist, normally in Shenzhen, China, and you're looking at a month or 2 months to get that PCB back. And so their innovation solved a real commercial problem within engineering companies. So I think it's fantastic, because you've got people, and the aims, normally people either kind of work on social or environmental problems, because that's where I think, you know, good innovation can really change lives. But then there's also some brilliant ones like the PCB example, where you're actually solving a really significant problem that has real commercial gains behind solving the problem in the way that they did. So I think that's why it's important. I think it inspires people to remember that actually technology can solve our problems. And there's a quote, this takes me back to my school days in geography. There's a woman called Esther Bozerat, and she talks about necessity being the mother of invention. And I think that the James Dyson Award is just one piece of reminding people of how important, you know, developing technology can be to us as a society. You now have a phone in your pocket that has, you know, 6 times the computing power of the module that landed on the moon. It's just bonkers, you know.
It's true.
And I think it's really important. And people like you and I definitely would share that view. And I think we've got to share it to the masses and get young people engaged in this stuff. And keep engineering and design as something that people aspire to work in. I'm very proud to work in this company because of that ethos. And I think, you know, James really believes that. You've got this Dyson Institute, and I've actually worked with some of the graduates that come into that, which is offering people a paid experience that gives them real industrial experience where they're not having to rack up huge amounts of debts. And then, you know, the end product is that the UK ends up with these phenomenally talented people that can go out and solve problems. I spoke to graduates that had turned down Cambridge University to take that opportunity. And wow. So, yeah, it's inspirational, you know. I work in quality and reliability, and there's some challenges, and you know, we all have our work problems. And you see stuff like that, and you know, what we tried to do with the Covent, and it does inspire you to stay with the company and be committed.
And you touch a lot on having products that solve problems, and or especially great ideas tend to be ones that are solving problems. I'd love to know from your perspective what you think makes a product great. Is it just that it solves problems, or is there also a large element of things like reliability, environmental factors and things like that? I'd love to sort of get your take on when you think of a product or a great product, how do you analyze that?
I think that's a really nice question. We to instill quality in every area of the business and actually go beyond the product. I think it's a really fantastic company. So we used to ask the question, what's a quality product and what's a quality company? And so I think it goes beyond the product. I think that it goes into your customer service as well. So, you know, I want a company I buy that cares about me as an individual, cares about my custom, not just on in terms of profiteering on you know, one purchase, but I want someone that really understands. And I think, you know, Apple have been phenomenal with this kind of ethos of, you know, someone comes in with a broken phone, it's okay, we'll sort the problem out, and they'll be a customer for life. So I think it now goes beyond the product. But specifically to your question, I think doing the job really well is important. I think quality and reliability is really significant as a product, because of just how much life you can get out of it. And, you know, I think there's a knock-on impact to that as well in terms of environment. You know, if products are lasting a significant period of time, it creates less forced obsolescence, which has environmental knock-on. But we're starting to really focus on sustainability at this company. And I also like stuff that is thinking about, you know, kind of sustainability. Like, how do you reduce the energy footprint of a product in use? Or how do you solve a health problem? And then I think if I take the question wider and actually remove Dyson out of the picture and talk about my own kind of thoughts, I think there's, when you buy something, you're essentially assigning yourself to a group in society. You're kind of saying, I'm buying this because I want to be part of the group of people that buy that. So other products can be about how you feel. Like, you know, when people buy a sports car, it's quite an emotive decision, and it's about how that product makes you feel as well. So I think it goes, I think it depends on the product that you're talking about, but people get really passionate. I love the games console discussions, you know, people are just like animalistic and tribalistic over what platform they're on. You've got your PC people, you've got your Xbox people, you've got your PlayStation people, you've got your Nintendo people, and they're so passionate about the company and the device. I find it fascinating. I do always find myself reading articles in that sector.
It is a crazy space, and it's yeah, I understand that part completely. If I tweet or say anything on TV or radio about any of the gaming consoles, I'll have someone from the other camp messaging me or something like that saying, "You're wrong. This one's better." It's bananas. And look, I've got to ask, I mean, you're obviously in Tokyo at the moment, but you've worked in a range of different countries across the globe. How much does the culture of a particular country play into the desire around a particular product, or even the focus that a product needs to have? I mean, you've touched on this a little bit already around the vacuum, being suited for different homes and sizes. Are there examples of that as well?
Definitely. Customer service is the one that jumps to mind. Mm. People have completely different expectations. So in Korea, we offer all the options that we have in Australia, but there is a demand to have someone come to your house and fix your product if needed. And same in India. You have different economic factors that enable you to offer different services, but it's very similar in India. If someone's product breaks, you distribute someone to the house, and that's an expectation. In other cultures, it's very different. You don't want someone coming to your house. You don't want that invasion of your privacy. So that's certainly a very different situation. And then, as I said, with some of our products, you have very different requirements from some of our products. So in countries like Australia and Japan, you've got really, maybe not this year for Australia, with the kind of bushfires and the back burning that's required. But typically in Australia, you have really good air quality, same with Japan. And so you really have to explain to people the problems of indoor air pollution, whereas people from other countries, which aren't as fortunate in terms of air quality, just understand that problem. So that's quite an interesting example.
Agreed.
As well.
Agreed. And it's interesting you touch on the customer service piece. There was, with our original Dyson V6, we had the issue where hair just starts to build up inside that vacuum head. And I remember I rang the Dyson customer service number, couldn't believe how quick I was talking to somebody. And then again, how quickly they were able to talk me through taking off the actual the brush head and actually being able to clean that properly. And it was crazy. And James, you've been mentioning a lot of quotes today, and I've taken note of some of them. One of the ones that was springing to mind as you were talking about things like quality, and for me, that quality stems into that customer service that we received as well. And there was one that I hear from Gucci, the guy who started the Gucci brand, and he said something along the lines of, you know, quality is remembered long after the price is forgotten. And
yeah,
I think that really does apply to Dyson, because I mean, the V11, for example, is an expensive vacuum when compared with others. But I'll tell you what, I didn't really think twice about getting that model, nor do I think about it when I'm using it. It's one of those things that the quality comes through and you remember that piece. No one cares about the price when it's just continually working so well.
Yeah, so really, funnily, a colleague of mine was the quality manager for Floor Care, and she actually used that quote on the footer of her email. Because obviously when you're talking about decisions, we want to prioritize quality over other variables like speed or cost from our perspective. So she used to put that in her footer as a reminder to people. So really nice quote. But yeah, I think there's one from Warren Buffett, and it's similar. So it's 20 years to make a reputation for yourself, and you can destroy it in 5 minutes. So, you know, the getting the machines right is really important to us. Really put a lot of extensive work into the testing and verification. So really abusive testing, you know, like dropping the machine. You just know that that's a requirement of consumers. It's so important. So you need to do your design process right. So I could give loads of examples, but you know, you test the example. We test the products for a representation of like years of life. Yeah. So you accelerate the test. So you'll have something that drops a machine like every 3 seconds to represent years and years of life, or you'll open a bin 3,000 times to make sure the mechanism lasts. Another one that we've introduced recently is something called FEA. So it's like computer-based modeling simulations. And it's been really important particularly with the lightweight products. So you can model where the stress is going to be in a material when it's dropped or banged against the wall. You can see the weak points. And so without actually having to physically test the part, you can start to thicken wall sections in the weakest part. And actually where you've got your overstrength, so where you might have way too much material, you can actually start to lean it out and reduce the weight or make the product more environmentally friendly. So that's coming in a lot. I would also say that from the car, the vice president of quality is Ian Menards, who's worked in the automotive industry. And so he's actually bringing a lot of practices from automotive where zero failures are acceptable. So we're really looking in the design phase. We do something called FMEA. So you try and predict like the worst case scenarios and then work out how you're going to solve it. Similar with safety. We kind of anticipate a component failing and then we go, okay, what's next? And, you know, on some of the heaters, which I think is really important because heaters and lithium ion batteries are not innovations that you want to mess around with. They can be very, very dangerous. On our heater, we have like 5 layers of security, and I think I was in a meeting once where we were talking about one of the fuses that protected a current trip, and I was working with who I think I called him the Yoda of engineering. His name was Nigel. He'd been with the company for 20 years, and if he didn't know something about engineering, it wasn't worth knowing. And we kind of discussed this fuse, and we couldn't actually ascertain a situation in which it could actually be used as a safety device. And we didn't remove it anyway, you know, so that's the kind of level of detail that you want to be in. But yeah, I think consumers are so switched on about quality and reliability. So whilst we do test the machines like incredibly robustly, and we're bringing in this FMEA and FEA and throwing all these new techniques at it to improve it even more. The idea is to continue to drive that down. I mean, and then as I said, the beautiful thing about Dyson is we're starting to think beyond the product. So with our customer service, any problem within 2 years, free of charge replacement or repair, to really make the users feel good about being a Dyson owner. I think that's really important as well.
It's amazing. And I know I want to get into the rapid fire questions very quickly, but before I do that, one last question around Dyson. The vacuum piece is something we've touched on a lot. And I know that it's at one point Dyson was considering a robot vacuum, and you were talking about Apple before. And I think that something doesn't exist until, from a mobile standpoint, until Apple does it. And we've just seen the impact when they've got a 5G iPhone coming. How far away do you think? I mean, you probably can't even say, but at least tell me, is the robot vacuum still being worked on?
Absolutely. So we do have a product out at the moment called RBO2. So it has 4 times the suction power of any other competitor. I'll say that for Japan, because I do not know the Australian market as well.
Yeah.
So we're massively innovating in that. We are currently trying, our strategy is we want something that works really well. So RBO2 is called the 360i. So it has a great big camera sensor on the top that maps the room through triangulation. And it really tries to clean effectively. It's also got it's got the cyclones in the device. So it's actually quite tall compared to competitors. But that enables it to get really good suction performance, not just a kind of gimmicky suction like I've seen on some competitors. But the robot is critical to us. We are constantly innovating on it, and expect more in that space. It's got a huge number of engineers working relentlessly to kind of pioneer that field. Watch that space, basically.
Good to know, because I mean, LG has a slightly similar product in the robot vac called the R9, I think it is, and it's got a small sort of cyclonic type vacuum holder at the back, and it's interesting, but it's not quite smart. It does get lost a lot, but anyway, that's a separate thing. Now, James, before we run out of time, I've got 7 questions for you. They're pretty quick and easy. First up, what is your favorite app to keep you organized? You sound like a busy guy.
Yeah, and Teams has been a lifesaver. So I don't know if you're familiar with Microsoft Teams, but
absolutely
during the COVID period, it has been phenomenal. You know, I manage multiple regions across Asia. Everyone is just a click of a button away from a video chat. It's working phenomenally. It does my calendar. I can do live messaging. And also, I've had some huge projects that involve multiple people in multiple nations having to work on the same project, and having a centralized file system is a lifesaver. I was slow to adopt it. One of my staff was pushing it for a while, and I deeply apologize, Rodrigo, for not getting on the bandwagon earlier, but it's just been phenomenal.
It is good. And James, what's your favorite social media app?
Well, I've shifted. I was a Facebook man. Because I love the connectivity. I had a childhood friend, age 10, and he moved to Russia, and we reconnected, you know, 15 years later. So it was Facebook. I'm really getting into Instagram at the moment. I just love the visual display of it, and I think there's a real dangers to it about people living this social media life and becoming obsessed with it. But I'm slightly guilty. I do really like having a flick through Instagram at the moment.
Makes sense. And when you do have 5 minutes to spare between meetings, what's the first thing that you do on your phone?
Oh, I flick between two. So it would be either be check my work emails. I'm a little bit of an addict, but then my online messages. So I have WhatsApp with the international family, and in Japan Line. So flicking between those two. And I am a bit of a news addict as well. So I love to flick on to BBC and just keep up to date with everything Boris Johnson's doing in the UK.
Makes sense. And do you wear a smartwatch or a traditional timepiece?
Oh, so this might be controversial. I'm not actually a watchman.
That's coming more and more.
My iPhone does everything I need. So I constantly have it in my pocket on charge. So for me, it removes the need for a watch. Might be controversial. I do love a traditional timepiece, though. You know, I think it's they're phenomenal engineering, very iconic, and looks very smart. So I would go traditional timepiece, but yeah, not okay. The most avid wearer.
All right, that's fine. And when we used to jump on aeroplanes, I'm sure we're going to get back to that at some point. Did you use the in-flight entertainment system, or would you bring your own device?
I'd use the in-flight entertainment system. I travel a fair amount, going back to see the family over Christmas, hopefully, if COVID allows. And in-flight entertainment system. I find with the tablet, you have to be organized, and then you haven't got the internet connection. So you have to kind of download and format anything you need. And I don't have that level of preparation when I'm traveling. I'm someone that's rushing to the airport.
I'm usually the same. And away from technology, what do you love to do to disconnect?
Oh, sport. I'm massively into rugby and tennis. So switch the devices off and get a really good workout. Just love a run around, particularly those two games. Just are what I like to do in my free time.
Excellent, excellent. And this show is called Technology Uncorked, and the Tuesday episodes are interviews like this one, and Thursdays it's me sitting with a glass of wine going through the technology news and reviews of the week. James, if we were in person and I could order you a drink, what would it be?
Oh, I'm a beer man, and I'm trying to cut down because of the calories. So there's actually a drink in Japan called Strong Zero. So right. You're talking 9% alcohol content, and it comes in the same size 500ml can. So whoa. I'm drinking that, and I don't like it as much as beer, but it's about a quarter of the calories. So that's my kind of new go-to. But yeah, conventionally, a beer man through and through.
Any particular beer you normally go to?
Oh, I do like Amstel. I don't know if you've heard
of
it. But
yeah, of course.
I will say Japanese beer is very, very good as well.
Yes.
So there's one called Sapporo.
Sapporo is nice.
Think is, yeah, well, you know it. Okay.
We have it here too. Yeah, no, we have it as well. And like Kirin Ichiban and stuff like that. We have a fair few Japanese beers now.
Right back at you, Jeff. What's yours?
Look, for me, on a beer side, we're really lucky in Australia. We've got a lot of nice craft beers coming in locally, so from Sydney or even Melbourne. But then usually for conversations like this, I'd do it over a glass of wine. Barossa Valley, we're really lucky. We've got some nice local wines here as well. But I'm pretty easy, to be honest. I can kind of, you know, lean either direction on a beer or a wine or potentially a spirit. But it depends. Depends on the mood.
whatever you've got.
James, you've been absolutely amazing, mate. I've taken up way more time than I certainly planned to, but amazing insights for me and even our listeners as well. So thank you so much for taking all the time today.
Beautiful. Anytime. It's been fun for me. So awesome. Anytime you need to know about Dyson, give me a call.